You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Debbie Keynote. Debbie, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Debbie, we're going to talk about your show at Kristen Tierney in New York running through April 20th. And for those that couldn't attend, of course, there's links in here for them to learn more about the show and see the works. But to begin with, this show is called Crosscut. And I'd like to talk about that title because that seems to relate to both of the work in here, right? We're talking about different ways of working, but also since this is a two-person show, it also has something to do with that dialogue, correct? Can you tell me a little about that?
Yes, correct. So the show, it's a two-person show of myself and Mark Sangbush. And Mark is a friend of mine and also an artist I just have known about and loved for a long time. So I was really honored when they asked us to be in a show together. And the title is, we thought of it as a metaphor for, Mark and I came up with it together, but like a metaphor for kind of like cutting through something or looking across. And because we both actually use, you know, like technology like a saw in our work, I thought it was a bit clever. And then also because, you know, there's a bit of joining with Mark's pieces in the show. He has these like almost puzzle-like wood pieces that join together that he then paints, kind of like tiles being put together. And then my work, often the canvases join together kind of like a puzzle as well. And so we thought it was a nice metaphor for all the horizontal joining that we do.
Yeah, I like that too. So let's talk about your work. There's so many interesting ones, and they're kind of, as you say, almost, you know, kind of way of fitting together. There's one called Iodes, if I'm saying that correctly, that looks like a star of it, almost like a star of David, two triangles. But it's so interesting because it you know, the way they're slightly shifted off, they create this, I think it's a hexagram in the middle, and they feel that they were painted that way. So, yeah, can you tell me a little bit about this? Because it's such a fascinating way of making what I see as a kind of multi-panel piece, right? Instead of a triptych, this is, you know, something quite a bit different, but close to that way of working in a sense, right?
Yes, totally. I'm glad you caught that. So that piece in particular has six canvases that are shaped like diamonds, and they all join together. And for those that can't see it in person, they're all kind of like slightly off of how they join, like rotating outward, so that the negative space between them all is actually a hexagon. And that piece is one of many pieces from the last maybe 4 years I've done where I join these canvases together. And it's kind of a system I've seen maybe here and there in different ways, but I've sort of made my own by using these brackets that join pieces sometimes in a circular fashion. So previously I had seen pieces, you know, maybe that were too big to be made in a studio. And so you get clever and you make like one or two panels and then you join them. And so I really liked that idea, but I wanted to take it farther. And I've always been interested in shaped canvases. I think partially because I did my master's in sculpture and my undergrad in painting and installation. So once I saw the way of looking at things in three dimensions through studying sculpture for 2 years, when I went back to painting, I kind of couldn't unsee that. And so I think of the canvas almost like the bones of it, almost like a sculpture itself. And so I'm looking at, you know, what am I using and what shapes? But at the same time, I'm really interested in painting, and I think that's where my work really belongs. And so it's become a nice way for me to bring these sculptural elements into painting. And I think there's something else there, too, of being a woman who grew up in rural America. And, you know, when I finally got to the, like, academic setting that I was in for undergrad, I was a little bit confused because all the artwork I had seen was, or that I was being taught, was often made by men, and it was often, like, very anti-craft. When it comes to, you know, like craft traditions like quilting or sewing or dyeing. And that was the kind of art I had grown up with. And so it's been nice to find a way to widen the canon. And I'm glad we're at a time where, you know, where the world is ready for like the Western art canon to widen. So that's kind of what I'm thinking about when I'm joining the pieces together and doing these fun, playful shapes.
Thanks for saying that. That's so important, that idea about, the canon widening, because that's been a long time in coming and is still in process, of course.
Totally.
Let's talk more about these. There's another one that has such unusual shapes in it. It's called Wax Cap. And this has, these are also panels, right? But
they're all canvases. And that's I think that, if you're not able to see the backs of them, I think that might be a little misleading at first, because you think, oh, this must be a panel, because some of them have actual holes in them, or they're pretty extreme shapes. But that's part of the game I play with myself, is like, how much can I push it into, how much can a canvas hold versus a panel? I like the language of canvas. I like the language of building those, those simple strips of wood up into a canvas. And I like that it's lightweight, and I like the bounce of it when I'm painting on it. But the particular piece you're talking about, Wax Cap, so that piece is a triptych hinged painting. And so the center panel is a square, but it has all these triangular cuts missing from the canvas. But the canvas is taut still, so it's stretched through those missing parts of the stretcher. And then there's two side pieces that hinge, and when they hinge close, they're vertical rectangular pieces. They close with just enough space to close perfectly over that initial square in the middle. And when they close, you can see the back of that it is actually a canvas, and it almost looks like a barn door or something when it closes. And that particular piece was a lot of work for me to make, and it was a bit of a risk, and I'm glad it turned out, and I'm glad I went for it. But there's a lot of holes, and just like getting my hands through those holes to stretch tightly was a real technical challenge. And then even painting on it, once it was stretched, it was like, oh man, this painting has so many missing pieces, and it's so complex. How do I complement that with my paint? I mean, I really enjoyed it, but it took definitely a few weeks. Just to paint it was really a challenge.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I want to ask you a little bit more about what you were saying earlier about your upbringing and initially seeing work that was anti-craft and largely made by men, and your dialogue with that, because that seems to be an important part of how you grew as an artist, right? Of how you came to be where you are now.
Yes. Yeah. And it's complex too. Cause I love men. And I was at the library yesterday checking out a book on Matisse. I have influence from that as well, but it's not my only influence. And I think sometimes, we tend to toss everything out when we've gone too far one way. So I'm trying to be careful about that and be like, no, I just want to have my influence balanced out to really represent me. And the part that really was missing from my undergrad experience was seeing more of a feminine art canon, and also seeing work that was, that was seen as folk art or outside art or craft, however you want to categorize it. But that stuff was always seen separately. And I did come across it occasionally, in an art history class that would look at it through that lens of folk art or whatnot, but or the arts and crafts movement, kind of seen more in the design world. But I've always felt that the line is much much more transparent than we realize, and so I've been determined to look at artists, and I've begun to found them as I got into grad school. More contemporary artists that had already started to do that work, like I think of Laura Owens, who has really looked at wallpaper and the arts and crafts movement and brought all of that into her paintings, or someone like Faith Ringgold, who had a hard time entering the art world, and so she was doing all this fabric work that would allow her to store it better and that was a bit more true to the craft she had grown up with. So pioneers like that really have kind of paved the road for me to be able to find my own journey.
Yeah. I appreciate that, and that's so true. The pioneers that came before. In another one, Perseids, if I'm saying that right. This is the one that's more of a burst, eight-pointed star. And also done in the same way, right? With shaped canvases, it's quite a process, I would think, just to assemble these. Mm. You know, I mean, wax cap sounds like that one you said is actually almost like an altarpiece. It's meant to fold, right? It can fold closed.
Yes, and it's available like in the gallery. It's offered for like when someone comes in. You know, the staff, they ask, oh, would you like to have us open and close it for you? So it's meant to be not so much that the viewer, you know, is like pulling on it, opening and closing it, but more that they can watch it open and close so they can understand a bit more of how it's made. And obviously somebody who owns it can move it. And I, when I'm in the gallery, I open and close it. So it's meant to be kind of like this piece that has movement and that can be viewed in the same way you would walk around a sculpture. You know, it offers different things from different angles. That happens with painting somewhat, but not as much. And I miss that about working in sculpture. And so I like that idea of kind of revealing different pieces. And it also, it links to things like children's toys, which is something I studied a lot in grad school. And I'm interested in the language of them and how they relate to architecture.
That's interesting. So tell me about that, children's toys, because that adds a different sense to this. That was something you studied and influenced your work.
Yes, definitely. And I think that comes up maybe a bit more conceptually these days, and definitely with the moving pieces I was talking about. But I like the idea when I was in grad school and I took an history of architecture class. Ended up getting really into like playground history and learning a bit about the like child psychology and how we design spaces for kids. And there's a lot of studies that talk about, you know, when kids, like all kids build forts, and we all, like, you know, that's part of childhood, like having imaginary spaces where we can find our own autonomy in a, you know, we're born into the house that our parents live in and such. And so we don't necessarily have autonomy over our environment, and so we find ways to create spaces that are shaped for our own, and kids are often fascinated by hidden passages or small, you know, spaces, and their imaginations are so rich they can see something small and imagine it huge, which I think relates to like engineering and architecture and how we design in as adults. And so I think about that when I'm designing those things, and you know, I enjoy that, exercising that muscle of my own, because I think we kind of lose it as we age if we don't engage with that playful, imaginative side. And so I like the design of children's toys. I find them very clever, and they definitely influence my work, even just aesthetically. I like the shapes that they use, and
Oh, that's so interesting. So, I mean, that was coming off of talking about wax cap, of course, which has an element that is somewhat interactive. I mean, as altarpieces are, right? I mean, altarpieces aren't a toy, of course, meant to be played with, but they have elements. And as part of that also, I mean, what comes to mind for me is as a child, and you know, this happens, I'm sure, with many others, but there's this often sense of, and as an adult too, of course, but wanting to touch the art, you know.
Totally.
This, and I don't know if that relates to toy making or some of your research and children's toys, but there's this sense of, you know, it should have like a specific word for it. When you know, you feel like you have to touch something and it's not so rational even. I remember I was a 14 or 15 year old, I'm in Sevilla in Spain at a museum with my parents, and it's almost like you're in a trance, but not really. Kids get into these states and I just reached out, and it was a Goya painting, and I just had to touch that collar because it didn't look real. And of course, you know, everybody freaks out, but it's that kind of thing, right? Like the collar looked amazing, right? It's like hard to believe. Yeah. And so does that relate to in a way, your work? Because your work feels that way. Obviously, wax cap you might want to touch. Other works you might want to touch as well. How does that relate to...
I'm glad you said that, because I think everybody feels that way, you know, like that, whether we're kids or adults, that, you know, there's all these rules set up, you know, for good reasons to keep things safe, but but that they're, you know, they can be a bit stiff or limiting. And I think, you know, I have a little bit of a design brain. And so where my mind goes is like, okay, so maybe it's just that not everyone can touch it, or not everyone can touch it in a way that might damage it, but that we should, that it might be possible to create experiences to satisfy, or like, you know, make the work more available without having it be, you know, everyone runs their fingers down it. So things like the hinging, I think about. And then also I think there's something nice about having almost like a secret being told that you don't get that when you see it on Instagram or on my website. And I think there's something special about that, and maybe brings the work back into the real world when we are living in a very digital age. So for the hinge pieces, like, I mean, sometimes, you know, someone will record a video of me standing there opening and closing them, and that does look very cool. But there is something to be said about seeing being there and being able to do it yourself, or see the wings open and then close, and then figure out how do they meet and how did she make this. And it's supposed to be handmade and have that feeling of, you know, anyone being able to make this versus something that like is a Jeff Koons sort of like came from a factory or a group of people in his studio, but more giving you more of the artist like process in front of you to see.
Yeah, that makes sense. And in the other work there, a recent work, Amanita, this is, mm-hmm. this also feels, I mean, they're all very different, but this one seems even more different, right? It's mm-hmm. it's built in a different way. It has a different way of kind of sitting on the wall. It still has that kind of hexagonal center like the first one we talked about, Iodes, mm-hmm. but quite a different piece here. This feels almost like it could be, I don't know, so something else. The others mm-hmm. feel somewhat geometric, are geometric. This one has mm-hmm. a very different, almost organic feeling to it, like an animal or an object or something.
Well, I'm glad you said that. Yeah, this one is, so it's also a hinged piece, and it has the same feature of having, like, you know, the center is more square and the sides make up the center. But what's different about it is that within that center square, the painting itself actually isn't square. It's made up of almost like diamonds, but they're a little bit longer on one side, so they kind of look like triangular diamonds. And they're all joined slightly off-kilter, like that first piece, Iodes, that we discussed, which leaves that same hexagon in the middle. And then the way that the wings come over to close and meet in the center is there, one is joined to the left side higher up, and one is joined to the right side lower down. And so when they close, they do so in this kind of almost like one of those doors that goes up, you know, like it opens the wrong way off of a car or something. It has that feeling like, oh, that's an unusual door, unusual way to close. And then when this one closes, it fits so tightly that I have a little, like a little latch that turns so you can close it and have it stay closed and stand back and look at it. There's a picture of that on my website. I don't think there's one on the gallery show page, but if anyone's interested in seeing it closed, you can see it on my website.
Very good. Yeah, there's links to that here, of course, so people can see more of that. Yeah, it's such an interesting process. And now that, you know, we're talking about games and more, that makes a that makes such a difference in terms of the sculptural aspect of them. There's one more I want to talk about, Arcturus, and this also is yet again a very different shape. I mean, I know there's some kind of repeating motifs in a number of these, but this mm-hmm. one feels, and now that we're talking about toys, almost feels game-like, almost like a spread of cards, but of course not really. Something mm-hmm. else is happening there, but it does feel like something that's... that can be playful, and the marks and the painting on themselves also has a playful quality to it.
Yeah, correct? Totally. Yes, you're right. And this piece, so that piece, Arcturus, it has a so it's eight pieces, but and there's no like center hole in this one, but the way that they join together is they're like triangles with a little like offshoot tail triangle added, which gives the illusion that almost like the piece is circling, or that it's somehow like notched, or that it's kind of hard to tell where the canvases are actually separating, because there's eight of them, but they're not they're joined on like multiple sides. It's kind of hard to explain, but if you see it at Kristen Tierney's website or on my website, you'll understand. But then the paint also, for all these works, but it really shows in this one, the paint continues, you know, over these divided canvases. And so there's, the canvases might not all be necessarily one piece, but when they're joined together, the paint flows over them as if they were. And that kind of reveals how I paint them, which is that, you know, I build the stretchers and then I dye the canvases, stretch them, and then I join them all together, and then I paint them as if they were one painting. And I like that bringing together, like that, it's almost like a glue of the paint on the surface. And I also enjoy the, like, the way that it, you know, because this one in particular, the canvases are alternating, so there's like an orange and then a green and orange and green and so on. Like the paint, kind of, I can play with that. I can keep it the same palette on each one, or I can have a color that is a different color that goes over both of them. And so it plays into that space that you're talking about of like it going forward and back and not necessarily being a recognizable, like you said, a splay of cards or something. It's not such a simple like rectangular canvas.
I like that. Yeah, it's so much fun talking to you about this show, this really beautiful show. And I want to ask you one more question, a little off topic. I'm always curious what everyone's reading. What are you reading at the moment?
Well, I just went to the library and I have a lot of books I'm going to begin reading. that's a big source of inspiration. I like to go and photocopy things and just take little clips here and there. But I'll tell you what I'm already reading, which is I'm almost done with this book called Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. I think it's a pretty popular book. It was a New York Times bestseller. But it's really great, and it talks about a lot of indigenous wisdom and just looking at the world we're in now through a creative and like really positive lens, but also with a cautionary lens of just, you know, where we are headed on our planet. And a lot of that, you know, a lot of thoughts on nature definitely show up in my work. So I look to inspiration in places like this for reading, and also like to nature, real nature in my physical real life. And then also I'm kind of on and off reading this book. I can't remember the title of it, but it's something to do with Annie Albers and the Bauhaus weaving. And it's a bit dense, even though it's not that long. So I keep coming back and reading maybe a chapter every month. And it's been really great just to kind of relearn the Bauhaus history and, you know, leaning more into that craft and understanding, you know, how Annie and all the other women there were navigating a very different time and creating these, you know, these ties between craft and architecture, because they weren't really allowed to have female architects in the Bauhaus, at least when she started. So she was finding ways to like shape space within the realm that she was working in, which was painting and drawing and, of course, weaving.
Thanks, Debbie. Thanks so much for putting together this show, but talking with me today. And again, listeners can learn more about the show through the links here. Thanks so much, Debbie, for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.